Welcome to the What Dreamers Do podcast. I'm your host, Carla Gover, an Appalachian musician, flatfoot dancer, mama, creative, and dreamer from Kentucky. I'm on a mission to inspire others to realize their dreams and live their most creative lives. Grab you a mason jar full of sweet tea or something a little stronger and pull up a chair, because it's time to get your dream on. Who's been following you? Because that's what dreamers do.
All right, so I'll just say, I am sitting here having coffee. Well, I'm having coffee. I don't know what he's having, with my old friend, Mr. Cycon, songwriter extraordinaire, many other accolades, but I'll just leave it at that for now. I'm so happy to be here talking with you.
That's all you're going to say?
Well, I mean, I wasn't prepared.
80 years old. You're just going to say I write songs?
This is impromptu, okay? We're off the cuff today. We're just inviting people in on our coffee chat. Would you like to brag on yourself, sir?
No, I don't do that. I'm a professional civil rights union community organizer with bad laryngitis this morning, and we stay in the background. We don't lean. We don't get out front. We lift other people up, and we make sure they get the credit. There's a lot of things I have done in this world, and no one will ever know that I was with the one that got him started.
Well, that's a beautiful philosophy, and I think that your songs are one of the awesome ways that you do that work, one of the most powerful ways that you do that work. But one thing I wanted to ask you, this is what's been on my mind, and so I'm just going to ask it. First off, you know, I was born in 1972, and some of the legislative hijinks that have been going on lately are the most alarming thing that I've seen in my lifetime. And I'm not sure how to respond. I know a lot of people feel really hopeless and powerless to fight like the big corporate government machine that seems to be ramming everything through. That's all dressed up in, you know, some sort of religious coding. Have you faced times that seemed this dire? And if so, what have you done in the face of it?
Well, first, I completely understand how people are feeling. It's a tough time. But at least my sense is that history in this country runs in regular cycles. You know, a friend of mine just said, this is the worst time in this country's history. You know what? It doesn't even come close. It doesn't even come close. You're talking about slavery. You're talking about the deliberate extermination of indigenous nations. You're talking about lynching. You're talking about the vigilante movements against the left, against the imprisonments of all dissidents. You're talking about deportations. And miraculously, and strategically, the people in this country, as the people in other countries, always organize, always fight back, and ultimately, at least so far, have always won. And I just think you just say, well, I think it's partly what you said, that a lot of what's happening is a deliberate attempt to tell people, it's hopeless. It's going to happen. You know, the ultra-right is going to take over. Nothing you can do about it. That's just a strategic move to keep us from organizing, to keep us from raising our voices, to keep us from fighting back. In fact, more of the people, by a significant majority in this country, want democracy. They want fairness, they want equity, they want all the things that probably you want and that probably I want. But a determined minority can raise a lot of sand and can convince the majority that it's hopeless. So I'm like, that's nice, guys. You're not going to shut me up.
Nice try.
You're not going to sit me down. You're not going to convince me that it's hopeless. You're on the losing side. History is on our side. Now, it is two steps forward and one step back. And but, you know, you can always do the two-step, particularly for Cajun, right? And, yeah, I'm just like, just shut the fuck up.
Well, I love that. That's a more hopeful take than you will hear coming at you from any different sides right now. And I like your two-step metaphor because I love to dance. And at this point, one of the things that I keep deciding and realizing is that I don't always know what to do, but I know how to bring people together to make music and dance and to create solidarity and to create community and connection and kinship and to celebrate our shared humanity. I have this project I work on called Cornbread and Tortillas, which you might have seen if you watched the recent special from the Music to Life organization I'm working with. But that's kind of where we just keep coming back to, well, you know, it's daunting, all of these forces of corporate fascist greed and oppression that we're fighting, but we're just going to keep singing and dancing.
Of course. Yeah. There's a quote from John, I don't know how to say it, Muir, Muir, M-U-I-R,
the great. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure who you're talking about.
Yeah, so I don't know. He says something like, you know, while you're fighting for the environment, take a little time to enjoy it. Go walk in the mountains. Go fish in the creeks. Go watch the sunset. Go admire the trees. He said, I can promise you one thing. You will not only have deep satisfaction, you will outlive the bastards. It's a good philosophy.
It's a great philosophy, and it relates to something that I have come to understand. You know, you always hear the, was it Nelson Mandela that said, be the change you wish to see in the world? I think. At least he's credited with it sometimes.
Yeah.
But he
probably didn't copyright it.
So probably not. But I have come to believe that just the energy that we carry with us in our hearts, the vibration of joy, happiness, love, acceptance, compassion, kindness, it's changing the world. Even if at that moment we're not marching, even if that moment we're not calling our legislator, that we're spreading in the world, it's powerful. And I think we sometimes discount it because it seems so simple and insignificant possibly, but it's not. It might be. It might be the most powerful thing that we as individuals can access. I'm not sure. What advice would you give to somebody who's just looking at this trans?
Hang with that old shaker hymn. It's a gift to be simple. Mm-hmm. It's a gift to be free. It's a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we have come to a place just right, by turning will be our delight. And I just think, you got to keep on keeping on. You can't, I'm not saying you can't, you know, get discouraged. That's only realistic. You know, okay, the last time I saw Sue Masick, mm-hmm. or the last time we met and continued seeing each other, when we were working on her one-woman musical about serial gunning called Precious Memories, we were playing in Louisville together at, hold on now, the Rudyard Kipling.
The Rudyard Kipling, yeah.
Right. So I didn't know about that, and I'm like, so I said to the proprietor, I have been hearing about this. I am so excited to be at one in the chain of British imperialist coffee houses, right up there with the Cecil Rhodes and the you know, Winston Churchill, you know. And one of my, I love taking sort of verbal jujitsu,
mm-hmm.
where you take something from them, throw it back at them, right? So there's this poem by Rudyard Kipling that I can't do the whole thing, but it's like, if you can stand your ground when those around you are falling, then you will be a man, my son. Somebody, not me. Came up with a great parody, which I just love. It's like, if you can stand your ground when those about you are falling all around you, then you don't understand the situation, right? Mm-hmm. So I just think, here's one of the things I learned as a longtime union organizer with the Textile Workers Union and the Mine Workers Union. There were many organizing campaigns when we were sure we had lost. And we got together as an organizing team and said, okay, clearly this has been a losing campaign. Let's call a shift meeting for after first shift tomorrow afternoon. We're going to have to tell the workers and our members that we just can't stay here. We're going to have to shut the union office. And maybe we can come back in 4 or 5 years, but let's face it, we've lost. And at 8 in the morning, the plant manager called up and said, okay, you guys win. We're ready to sign a contract.
Wow.
I've also been through campaigns where he said, oh, this one's so easy. No way we could lose. And guess what? So to me, the lesson is that you never actually know whether you're winning or losing. No matter how long you've been at it, no matter how savvy, how shrewd, in fact, no matter how skillful you are, you actually never know. So therefore, you should never give up. Now, you should take rest breaks. Like you said, Carla, you should dance. You should make love. You should spend time with your kids, your friends, your grandkids, you know, your grandpa, your grandma, you know, just because we're fighting for justice doesn't mean we can't live good lives. And we don't want to set an example for other people, young and old. We're thinking, yeah, maybe I should be an activist. Maybe I should be an organizer. We don't want to lead such sacrificial lives that anybody would want to be like us. I lead a deeply good life. I don't remember who it was that said to me, Sai, it's just wonderful how you have sacrificed yourself all your life for justice. And I said, listen, I never sacrificed anything. I have a great love. I have a great life. I got kids. I got grandkids. I've got a union pension. And I've got Social Security. I play music. I listen to music. You know, I'm not a good dancer, but every once in a while I try. I visit with my friends. And I fight passionately for justice. You know, my father was a rabbi, and he was the campus and community rabbi at Penn State during the great football years. Yeah. There was this coach, you know, Joe Pastrano, whatever, Pastrami, whatever. But, you know, it wasn't him. It was my old man, who's a working class kid who loved contact sports, and he had the direct line. When he came to town, they started winning. When he left, they started losing. I'm just saying. And Pomp had this great saying. He was what we call Shomer Shabbos. If you've watched John Goodman in The Great Lombowski, you've heard him say that. It just means I keep the Sabbath religiously. And I once asked Bob, because I'm not. I'm profoundly secular. I'm profoundly and gratefully Jewish in terms of the good politics, not the bad politics. Every faith, every religion shares. I said, did you find it hard to keep the Sabbath? And he said, yes, I kept the Sabbath, but it's even more true that the Sabbath kept me. That the Sabbath kept me. Carla, this is how I feel about having been in the movement all my life. I tried to keep the faith. I hope that I did. But the movement kept me. It gave me a life of meaning. I don't doubt that I tried hard to live a good life and to work for justice. I'm not saying I always succeeded. I know that I sometimes succeeded, but I am grateful to have been in this beautiful movement for justice, what Dr. King called the beloved community. Mm. And my life is better for it, and I didn't sacrifice a damn thing.
Well, the Stanley Brothers advertise for Martha White Flour, so I'm going to do a sort of cooking advertisement here to support this podcast. I have a confession to make. I love to cook from scratch, but many nights these days, I'm only cooking for my son and myself. When I'm busy and tired, sometimes it's a little bit too easy to get takeout, so I decided to try some of those meal kit boxes that I saw advertised, and I went through four different ones until I found the one that I like best, Home Chef. Every week, I get to pick four meals that I think my family would like, and they send the ingredients right to my door. This isn't processed food either. It's just healthy meats, fresh vegetables, and grains that I prepare. It usually takes me 30 minutes or less to get supper on the table, and my picky son loves every meal. Plus, it's way cheaper than takeout. If you want to try it out, just go to carlagover.com/supper. I don't get paid for this endorsement. I just truly like the product. And if you sign up using my link, they will send me credits toward my own boxes. And with an almost 13-year-old boy in the house, I could use them. Plus, all that good food is going to help me keep recording this podcast for you. Just do me a favor and don't tell Granny.
Well, amen. I feel the same way. And even though, you know, my journey looks different than yours, I feel like I've been in this community of folk music and social change and social justice action since I can remember growing up in the coal fields of Eastern Kentucky. And I feel so blessed and fortunate, mainly by just the people, the inspiring people that also never give up and that continue to fight in their own ways. They write poems, they write books. I hang out with a lot of artists, but I think it's important to remember, and this is kind of what you were saying, reminding me of it, is that we all have to find our own way to engage with justice and our, you know, fighting for our collective liberation is really what we're talking about. But somebody who works in banking or finance might approach it very differently than somebody that is a folk singer, you know.
Well, of course, and, you know, and one of the reasons that I've been helpful as a strategist in a number of corporate campaigns is I've got friends who work for corporations, and I have friends who work for, you know, the agency that sell stocks and stuff. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have been very happy to leak material to me that I could pass on.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I know one thing, you know, I introduced you as a songwriter, and of course I'm aware of your deep history and connection with labor organizing and unions and and that sort of thing. But for me, you know, as a songwriter, and especially because I grew up in Whitesburg with the Apple Shop organization, and you had that early album with them. And so my first introduction to what you do, obviously, was as a songwriter, and your powerful songs that are really in the voice of common people and reflecting the struggles of common
Thank
people.
Thank you. That's what I aim to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a compliment.
I'm just wondering if you can think of an instance or two, or just anything that you would care to share about a moment or a time when a song or music has really made a big shift or a big difference in the kinds of work that activism that you do, whether your own song or someone else's song. I mean, I'm sure there must be many. I'm putting you on the spot. You guys, this is just like, we made a coffee date, and then I was like, hey, why don't we record this as a podcast? So this is our impromptu riffing. We're riffing.
You didn't put me on any spot. It's totally reasonable. Totally reasonable question. Okay. All right. Visual. This is not a visual podcast, right?
It's not. So what does your shirt say? Musicians United to Protect Bristol Bay.
Right. Okay. Okay. So I'll try to do a short version, but having been in the South since I was 21 and being Jewish, short stories are not my strong point. Right. Okay. So back in, I think 2010, I get an email that says, Sai, you don't know me, but I know your music. I'm a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay, Alaska. You probably don't know where that is, but give me a call. I'm curious enough to call the guy's name is Dan Strickland. He's been a commercial fisherman all his life. He's also a folky, you know. I find out later, he's got a couple of Martins, much better than anything I've ever roped. But, you know, he fished in Cordova and knew the Exxon Valdez spill. Mm. Now, I am old enough to know that most of the things I remember, most of the people I know and work with weren't born yet. So I explain everything. Exxon Valdez was an oil tanker that spilled oil. Guess who it belonged to? Exxon Valdez, right? And destroyed the commercial fishing and the fishing for subsistence and again, fishing for sport in Cordova, probably for several lifetimes. There's so much oil on the bottom that nothing can live. So Dan and his family, all of whom fish commercially, moved to Bristol Bay. Bristol Bay is an inland ocean in the southwest quarter of Alaska. If you imagine that necklace of islands called the Aleutians that stretches out towards Russia. By the way, Sarah Palin was wrong. You can't see Russia from her living room. I was up in her daughter's town, but it's, you know, a guest of some friend of Dan's, and I said, I can't see Russia. And so you got to get up on this chair. And I'm like, that chair don't look real safe. So I didn't get up on it. Never got to see Russia. So Bristol Bay is the source of the richest remaining wild fishery of wild sockeye salmon in the entire world. It's sustainably managed. This last year, 90 million salmon. 90 million salmon were caught in Bristol Bay after some 8 million were allowed to escape so they could spawn, and there would be 90 million next year. So a Canadian mining corporation decided 20 years ago, they wanted to build the world's largest open pit gold and copper mine right near the headwaters where the salmon spawn. There has never been that kind of mine in the history of the world. that didn't eventually destroy everything downstream. And from the beginning, primarily the indigenous people of Alaska, Alaska is 25% indigenous, started fighting against the mine. So Dad says, he explains to me the great fight that brings together people who fish commercially, people who fish for subsistence, for survival, people who fish for sport, environmentalists, political leaders. And he says it's a great campaign, but we don't have a theme song. He said, if you will come to Alaska and write us a theme song, we're not going to pay you for this, and you're going to have to get yourself here, but we will give you all the homemade beer you can eat, you can drink, score one. But yes, you know, and all the smoked salmon you can eat, straight to my Jewish heart. Right. So I went, and it was that great song, Maggie May, not the one from Rod Stewart, but the one from Anthony, the great maritime J.D. Cormier, about a boat called the Maggie May. And he talks about this kid who starts as a deckhand and that day turned into 30 years. That phone call turned into a dozen years going back and forth to Alaska, writing not a theme song, but an entire cycle of songs about the struggle to stop the mine and protect the native languages, cultures, ways of life, subsistence, the economy, the boats, the history, the culture of this amazing part of the world. And, you know, so, Carla, I think of myself in some parts of my songwriting as a musical journalist, right? Mm-hmm. As a translator, right? So I told Dan, and the only human being I knew in Alaska, Suzanne Little, a state senator and bluegrass band leader, who I actually called her up and said, hey, is this guy Dan on the level? I mean, you know, am I going to go there with $100,000 that I, of course, keep handy and, you know, get mugged? She said, no, he's great. You should come. So I told them, I will be your musical journalist. I will be your translator. But you have to introduce me to the people who tell me their stories. Carla, I'll bet I listened to 60 different people. I sat in a third grade classroom in one of those desks. My knees will never be the same. And I said to these indigenous kids who were like 10 and 11 and 12, I will be your messenger. If you tell me what you believe people in the lower 48 need to know, I will try to put that message into a song. And when I've written it, I will send it back to your teacher, and she will sit down with you and you'll listen again and again. And if I've got stuff wrong, you'll tell me and I'll try to fix it. And if I can't fix it, we'll just throw it out. Mm-hmm. So I wrote 30 songs, made an album as a fundraiser with Dan and Suzanne, built an international organization of musicians who also wrote songs, who also contacted their fans and friends because, hey, as musicians, we're in internal communication systems. You did this beautifully. You know, you said that your Cornbread Express, you know, just before breakfast, you know, with so many good things to eat, so many good things to smell and to taste. But you've got a lot of people you can communicate with. All of us musicians and other artists. We're an automatic communication system. So we used Musicians United to get the word out in places where the word wasn't getting. And I field tested the songs we had. Dan and Suzanne live in little different parts of Alaska. We had gatherings at each of their homes, and I would sing a song, and then we would discuss it. Did I get it right? Did I get it wrong? Is there something that needs to be changed? Does it make sense? So that was like a first step in giving the songs back to the people that they were about. They're not my songs. They're not my stories. They're their songs. They're their stories. And I will tell you, there were some fights. I have a song called, I can never remember the name, Out on the Lake. And I originally wrote it as a Cajun song, and it was out in the swamp. And then my friend John Vesner had just lost his father, so we changed it to an Upper Minnesota song, and then I rewrote it as a Bristol Bay song. And there's a line that said, as I cast my lure towards the early morn. Okay, the next thing I know, some guy, these are the guys who get into the fights, not always though, says, Si, you know, real people who fish, we don't use lures.
No lures.
We don't use lures, you know? It's easy to fool a bass with something that looks a little bit like a bass and flaps and make a lot of noise. The real skill is in presenting a hand-tied fly to a trout. So you got to change it. I cast my fly towards the early morn. All right. Other side of the room, somebody stands up. Hold on there, buddy. Fly looks like a fly. Lure doesn't look anything like a fish. Doesn't look like anything at all. It takes skill to make it move and imitate the movement of a fish. That's what a real person who fishes, who's fished for years, that's what we use. I'm going, you know, I've got my hand over my face and thinking, how did I get into this? How do I get out of this? But I don't have to. So Suzanne Little's husband, Bob Owens, who's the assistant city attorney for Anchorage, capital of Alaska. I'm sorry, Anchorage. Juneau is the capital of Alaska. You know? Yeah, I've even got a song about that. So Carla, I got to talk about everything, you know.
Live
a long time. You got to do that. Bob says, gentlemen, I think we need to find a compromise position here. Tom, when you use that fly, what do you attach it to? He says, Bob, don't be an idiot. I tie it onto a line. Ed, that lure of yours, what do you tie it onto? Bob, everybody knows you tie a lure onto a line. Gentlemen, I believe we have a solution. Si, how would you feel about saying, as I cast my line towards the early morn? That's how I recorded it, right?
That's consensus building right there.
Pardon?
That's consensus building.
Exactly. Activity. I didn't do it.
It reminds me of it.
Wringing my hands. So, and then Suzanne and I took it all over the state, right? We played in schools with her band Food for the Soul, sometimes just the two of us. We played in gatherings of people who fished. We were hosted by indigenous leaders. You know, we went, I think my favorite was on the right before the salmon season opened, and everybody was running in to get a, you know, we're settling for their torture to get a new sump pump or new rings for their VA maritime engine. And we were there outside the maritime supply store, you know, with our amps and with a young woman who was registering people to vote. And they're like, hey, guys, I'm sorry, I don't have time to listen. We're like, well, we know that. Just register to vote. You know, okay, I can do that. Now I got to go. So I think, you know, and we did interviews on the radio. We showed up. So I think, you know, when people say, well, you guys sure won that one, I'm like, no, actually, we were not at the front of the fight. We were in the back of the fight. We were maybe 1%, 1.5% of the victory. But victories are won by tiny margins. And it is just true that every vote counts. And it's just true that there are no small jobs in a movement for justice.
Well, I like that story for a lot of reasons, but also because I think it points to the fact that really worldwide, a lot of the environmental movements are being led by indigenous peoples, you know, in Brazil and South America, because, you know, in some cases still they're the ones that live most closely with the land and see and are affected by most immediately the devastation that can occur when unchecked industry is allowed to do whatever it wants to our natural system. So I think it's a great thing to, you know, as a songwriter or as a, you know, person with white privilege or whatever, or as a person with resources, to throw our efforts many times behind already existing movements instead of feeling like that we've got to start from scratch. And that's one thing I've learned in working with the Latinx communities here in Kentucky, is just, I feel like part of my job is helping to create stages and experiences where I can amplify voices.
Well, that's it. And we have a podium.
Mm-hmm.
We do. So, yeah. So I've been married for 40 something years to Elizabeth Minnick, who is a philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're a broomstraw philosopher. yeah. You know, and Elizabeth has multiple heritages, including Appalachian. And one of the many things that I've learned from her is that we actually don't know how many things we've stopped. Right? We know some of them. But we don't know how many wars never happened. We don't know how many atrocities never took place. We don't know how many, you know, environments were preserved because of our work. She says, and I believe, we've been far more successful than we'll ever know, because often the people on the other side, I don't mean to generalize, but the evil people, they think, it reminded me, one time, our youngest son, Gabe, named after my grandfather, was about 2 years old. And Elizabeth and Gabe and I were walking through the woods. And Elizabeth, who's tall and strong and looks like where she came from, or at least part of her family came from, she looks mountainy, tripped over a root and fell. It's totally uncharacteristic. And Gabe said, I didn't know big people fell down. And then another time, Gabe and I used to wrestle at night, and I had pulled some muscle, and I said, honey, I just can't. I'm hurting too bad. And Elizabeth said, well, I'll wrestle with you. And he said, oh, I'm not wrestling with you. You're a big woman. Right? Okay, maybe there's some gender bias in there, and maybe not. But I think oftentimes the people who want to do devastating things look at us and say, no, it wouldn't be wise to take them on. Wouldn't be wise to take them on. They've got a history. They've got courage. They've got strength. They've got smarts. And they're going to organize in a heartbeat. And it's going to hurt us. It's going to hurt us. So let's just do it somewhere else. And I think Elizabeth's point is, we never see that. We don't know that, but I think she's right.
Oh, I love it. Since I was a child, I've always been obsessed with those places in history, those moments, those stories that you read about where you can see that one individual really made a difference, you know, Rosa Parks or somebody like that. I've always loved those kinds of stories. And that's kind of what you're talking about, is just this idea that we never know when there's been some kind of critical cusp or nexus point.
Exactly.
that came down in the side of, you know, best outcomes for all concerned that we played a part in, and we don't know, and we'll never know.
Exactly. Exactly. But the fact that we'll never know should not discourage us.
Right. I'm going to add professional troublemaker to my tagline, I think. So it's kind of what we're talking about.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, if you don't mind another Elizabeth story, you'll get lots of them. So I wrote this book I've written a bunch of books about organizing. And then, but most of them are the model for, I think, the second one was the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook. You know what? Big, thick cookbook.
Yeah,
you can look up. Yeah, well, it's Elizabeth and I actually have four editions going back 50 years because recipes keep changing. So as you go in the back, it's like, oh, cauliflower. How do you prepare cauliflower? And then it sends you to the recipe page and it says, first you do this, right? Mm-hmm. So I wrote all these, you know, step-by-step organizing handbooks. And then I thought, you know, that's actually not how I help people learn how to organize for power, for change. I sort of turn them back on their own experiences. Because anybody who's raised three kids is a natural organizer. They just have to take that experience and translate it into a different arena. And I don't tell people that stuff. I tell stories. I sing songs, right? Not exclusively. Sometimes you just have to say, no, it's like this. So the next book I wrote on organizing was just stories from the road, right? Mm-hmm. And I believe that when you are an organizer, you think like an organizer in that corner of your life. Just like if you're a musician, you hear songs differently than most people hear them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I told all these stories and included all these songs. And because I do things as an organizer, I wrote to about 75 of my friends across a really wide range of things they do. Said, here's a description of a book I've just written. I need a title and a subtitle. What do you think? So the quite wonderful artist, musician, Mara Levine, and her mother stayed up all night and came up with Creative Community Organizing. The great blues musician, Scott Ainsley, who almost always tours with an African-American partner, came up with a guide for rabble-rousers and activists. Right. So I think, okay, I thought, Creative Community Organizing, good title. A guide for rabble-rousers and activists, good subtitle. So I opened a manila folder, took out a Sharpie, not a Sharpay. A Sharpay is a dog. I took out a Sharpie and I wrote Creative Community Organizing in big letters. And then underneath it, in somewhat smaller but still legible letters, I wrote a guide for rabble rousers and activists. Went and knocked on the door of Elizabeth's home office. She said, come on in. I said, I said, you know, I've been trying to get a title for my book. What do you think of this? And I held it up. And she said, it's wonderful. And what about all of us, quiet lovers of justice? So that became the title, right? Creative Community Organizing, a guide for rabble rousers, activists, and quiet lovers of justice. I will say that Elizabeth happens to be a superb organizer. And while she is sometimes a quiet lover of justice, sometimes she's a very eloquent organizer for justice and lover of justice. So I think that's the role that all of us artists can play. Because I think we help people learn both from our experience and from their experience. And I think that's something that actually works.
Yeah, well, I love that title. So I'm excited to read that book. Is it still available? Is it still in print?
It's in your inbox.
That's the one you sent me. Okay. You sent me several things. I'm super excited.
You want a real quality paperback? You'll see. There's an order form.
Okay. Well, I'm going to share that with my listeners as well, if that's okay.
With
my listeners on my podcast, I'll share the information about how they can, you know, listen and read. Is it okay if I share it? I can edit this part out, but whatever you want me to share, I'll share.
Let me think. I can only give away so many free copies before my publisher finds out.
Oh, sure. Well, I can just put a link to where you purchase it. That's fine. That's no problem.
But you can certainly share the electronic copy with anybody that you want to have it. Because I didn't know that you were going to do that.
I didn't know I was going to do it either, but I will. What I'll do is I'll just share. I want people that are listening to be able to have a way that they can
work this out. Okay.
Access.
I've got something at, at 11. And as much as I'd love to keep talking, you know, say, hey, so this is wonderful. Really wonderful.
Yeah, it's been so great to catch up. I feel like we've just barely scratched the surface. And hang on just a second. There was one more thing in closing that I wanted to ask you.
See, what I'm thinking is you scratch the surface of my dining room table, you're in trouble.
Scratch the surface of your dining room. Oh, you should see my dining room table. It's kind of deliberately scratched because of all the kids' artwork and everything. It's just...
Right.
It's super scratched.
Yeah, we had to get a new one. Hey, Sue, this is wonderful. We will continue.
Okay, well, it's been so great to talk to you today. Yeah. And I'm going to put a link where people can go read more about you and listen. And hopefully we can just do it again soon. It's so wonderful to reconnect.
Oh, no, we have to do it again soon.
Okay. All right. Well, you have a great day.
All right. You too, Carla. Take care. Be well.
Okay. Bye-bye.
This episode of What Dreamers Do is sponsored by the online Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging Academy, the only course of its kind and the most comprehensive step-by-step program available for dancers learning this style. I teach beginning and intermediate students the steps and skills they need to dance to traditional mountain music so that they can be confident, joyful dancers and improvisers. Unlike others who just teach the same handful of steps or who just teach routines, I give you not only a bountiful library of steps, but a framework for understanding how the steps fit together with the music. Learn more about the Academy and get started for free with my video tutorial, The Three Essential Steps for Appalachian Flatfooting and Clogging. Visit www.carlagover.com today. It's a holy